Guten Tag, friends and neighbors. I am Ben Bratwurst Bolin, and as always, joined with my co-host, Noel, I'm going to give you a nickname, Noel de Berlinger Brown.
I reject my nickname and your nickname. You can do better.
You can't reject my nickname. You can only reject your own.
Okay, I reject my nickname, and I accept yours with open arms. As it turns out, though, I am the one most qualified in this room to give German nicknames, my friend. For I was once a young German boy.
You mentioned on a previous episode that you did live in Germany until the age of 6.
I did, and then I fell out of a treehouse, and I lost all of my memories of my childhood. And that's true. It's very true, except for the memory loss part. But I do have a very distinct, terrifying memory of falling out of a treehouse that was overlooking the soccer field and everyone surrounding my broken body. And from then on, I couldn't speak German anymore.
And that was Thursday. That was last Thursday, right? Or were you a child?
Well, it happens periodically in my life.
There are a lot of tree houses in your life, I'm finding.
A dangerous amount, in fact, and I'm always drawn to them despite my troubled history with tree houses. And yet here we are to talk about sausages, sort of, by way of Zeppelins.
Yes, and some of you may be saying, hey, Ben, hey, Noel, how the heck are you going to pull that one off? Well, don't worry. We will tell you. But first, we want to give a shout out to our super producer and fellow Treehouse fan, Casey Pegram.
I'ma catch him. I'ma catch him. Nah, he's too quick.
Now, when we say Zeppelin, this may be a huge plus to some of us. This may be a huge downer to others. We mean the vehicles. We mean the airships, dirigibles. We don't mean Led Zeppelin, the band.
Although it does turn out that Keith Moon, the insane, incorrigible Keith Moon, drummer of The Who, the late drummer of The Who, coined that term, Led Zeppelin, when he heard the boys that would go on to become Led Zeppelin playing under their current name, the New Yardbirds, and said it would go over like a Led Zeppelin. In other words, he thought it were shite.
As smart as a screen door on a submarine, right? But yes, Zeppelins, they're a real thing. You have seen them in the past. You have often, perhaps, mistaken a blimp for a Zeppelin, but there's a very important difference, one that we covered on Car Stuff, but we should examine today.
Let's set the record straight. Ben, give it to us.
Well, both of them work the same way, right? Both blimps and Zeppelins work by being lighter than air. They're filled with a gas that's lighter than oxygen.
And so, also intensely flammable.
And intensely flammable. There's a great article from Mental Floss called Blimp versus Zeppelin, What's the Difference? And as you all know, we are big fans of Mental Floss over here. And we think this is an important difference to make. So both of them work by being lighter than air and having the same approach as a hot air balloon, but a Zeppelin has a rigid structure, a skeleton, if you will, a frame beneath this. It makes it more suitable for longer trips, but it also makes them predictably more expensive.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, the guy that invented the Zeppelin has a delightfully evil-sounding German name. Maybe I just think all German names sound evil, especially if they're related to the Nazis. But his name was Count Graf Ferdinand von Zeppelin. And he created this monstrosity, and the idea was that it would be a steerable balloon, because like you mentioned, Ben, a hot air balloon, you can make it go up or down by releasing different weights, but it's very hard to steer it. A blimp, on the other hand, does not have that rigid structure, and it was named, apparently, according to this Mental Floss article, the name dates back to 1916 and supposedly is an onomatopoeia for the sound that it makes when you thump a balloon. Blimp.
That's great. Also, Count Zeppelin, as a fascinating side note, part of his inspiration for airships came from being an unofficial observer in the American Civil War. He was with the Union Army.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But why are we talking about the structure of these Zeppelins? Well, to answer that question, we will have to go to World War I. And, you know, you can set the scene, you can picture the incredibly horrific deployment of various chemical agents, right? You can also imagine, as you've seen in so many films about this period in time, you can also imagine the brutal trench warfare that's occurring. But it wasn't all people fighting on the ground.
No, in the sky, there were buzzing planes dropping bombs and dive bombing and zipping this way and that. And then in the front, approaching you from the distance through the hazy fog of war, is this formidable shape coming ever so slowly towards you. And it is a scary mother, isn't it, Ben? And it's the Zeppelin.
It is as imposing as its name. This is a massive cylindrical balloon that has a metal skeleton, and it's filled with hydrogen, as we noted before. It can steer in and out of enemy territory. They have a heavy hum that lets people know a bombing raid is about to begin, and Germany was doubling down on Zeppelins at this time. They felt that raids led by Zeppelins would give them a clear advantage in war tactics.
Yeah, largely because of that fright factor. You know, they were absurdly menacing. I mean, it's such a trope, too, when you think about, like, kind of steampunk sci-fi. The idea of that menacing, hovering Zeppelin is always sort of a feature in the background. Games like the Bioshock game that had that kind of, like, alternate, you know, post-Civil War world, you know. Zeppelins play a huge part in that. And I think the big boss fight at the end is inside this menacing vehicle. But they weren't incredibly effective at actually killing people. They could carry large payloads, and you could drop bombs from them, and they could transport personnel. But because they flew at such high altitudes to make them more difficult to detect, it was pretty tough for them to drop bombs with any real level of precision, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't have a technology that would allow them to pinpoint an area, even roughly speaking. So their primary purpose, their primary use, was to move supplies and troops and to function in a surveillance capacity, which, by the way, some airships still do today, very high in Earth's atmosphere. Throughout World War I, Germany's 140 Zeppelins were only responsible for around, 1,500 deaths?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a pretty good stat for killing.
Yes, and one thing that you and I both found fascinating, and I don't know about you, my friends, but I was not aware of this until our research for this episode began, it seems that Zeppelins affected German citizens even more than they affected citizens of enemy nations, but in an unpredictable way.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's possible that more than 1,500 Germans died from lack of sausage. No? Okay, that's a bit of a stretch. But seriously, though, they did have to give up their delectable encased meat tubes because these Zeppelins, that casing that we're talking about that you use to make sausage, turns out that functions pretty well as an airtight balloon material, which is what they used to make these Zeppelins.
Right. Specifically, they found the most effective material for encasing hydrogen was something called gold beater skin.
I love this.
This sounds so weird. It's just the word gold and beater together. Gold beater skin. This substance is made from cow's intestines. You know, you source those from butchers, right? And in World War I, they sourced it from Austria, Poland, northern France. Here's what happened. You wash the cow intestines, you skin off the external membrane, and then bathe them in an alkaline mixture, stretch them out to dry, and you've got this stuff named gold beater skin. Before the age of Zeppelins, it had a different use.
Yeah, they used it. Jewelers used it to wrap around pieces of gold that they could then hammer out in those super papery thin gold leaf layers. And I had no idea about that, and I think that's fantastic. Gold beater skins. But then, of course, we know sausage is basically just ground up meat that's encased in this lining. And it's a perfect material for filling with the sausage meat. And then you've got this self-contained packaging that you can also eat. And it gives it a nice snap. And when you grill it, you get nice grill marks on it. Everybody likes a good sausage. If you didn't have that, it would just be ground sausage, like breakfast sausage that you'd form into your own patties. And not nearly as sexy.
No, not nearly as sexy. And without this component of sausage, we also wouldn't have, we being human civilization, not just Noel Casey and myself, we wouldn't have effective Zeppelins because they found that they could modify this gold beater skin by moistening the skin and then patching the pieces together into larger sheets. When they patched these together, the sheets would dry with airtight seals.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture that. So you'd have these, like, just they would lay out in giant warehouses just these patches and sheets of guts and then just wet them down and then kind of, like, stick them together and then let them dry and then they would seal up perfectly. This just seems like, whose idea was this? And how did they decide, okay, this is actually going to work. We're going to be able to fill this with hydrogen and have people hanging from it, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet up in the air.
Right. How did they figure this out? Human ingenuity is astonishing. I've always loved to picture some guy like the older man in the Kids in the Hall sausage eating sketch who is just trying to, maybe he's trying to fuse sausages together and then boom, he invents the Zeppelin. I know that's not how Count Zeppelin actually discovered this, but it's a cool idea. And regardless of the origin, no other material could seal this tightly.
Mind blowing. So, like I described a minute ago, I mean, I don't know if this is exactly how it was done, but I'm picturing just sheets and sheets of this stuff laid out. And when I say sheets and sheets, I mean the product of about 250,000 cow guts to make a single hydrogen gas filled Zeppelin. And as much as Germans loved their Wurst, they decided they were going to double down on this long range bombing technology, at the risk of maybe never having a delectable sausagey treat ever again.
So let's do the math. 140 Zeppelins over the course of World War I on the German side, and then 250,000 cow intestines per Zeppelin. That leads us to 35 million cow intestines.
Jeez Louise. And it became a big deal to keep track of whether or not butchers were delivering these byproducts to the state, right, Ben?
Yeah, absolutely. You would have agents of the Kaiser monitoring every butcher in areas that Germany controlled. So again, Austria, Poland, northern France, and of course, Germany. Interesting story about northern France, Noel. For a time, the butchers there were not allowed to make sausage.
Verboten.
Yes, yes. That's German for forbidden.
I don't know what French is for forbidden. Casey?
Interdit.
Cool. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been Casey on the case.
Ladies and gentlemen, what would we do without super producer Casey Pegram? So to my co-host earlier point here, when we picture this idea of making this gold beater skin and then further modifying it to make this envelope for hydrogen, the question we have to ask ourselves is, how did this actually happen? And here's a weird aspect to this story. In a documentary called Attack of the Zeppelins, a University of Cambridge engineer named Dr. Hugh Hunt notes that there's not much surviving information on how these were constructed.
And not only that, Ben, despite them not being the most effective weapons of war, they were kind of tough to shoot down for a couple of reasons. They were so high up, we didn't really have super precise long-range weapons for just like shooting them full of holes or whatever. And it was pretty impervious. Like you could shoot one with a bullet and it wouldn't immediately go down. It would like have a like pop a slow leak. But this material was so relatively sturdy and rigid, I guess, that it wouldn't just deflate like a balloon getting poked with a needle. Actually, they ended up having to come up with kind of special techniques for taking down these Zeppelins. Did you hear about that?
Right, right. This gets a little bit into James Bond territory. They would fire these bullets that contained phosphorus, incendiary bullets, and they would fire a massive amount of them at once.
Just a barrage. And as we mentioned before, and as you may have heard in the tragic case of the Hindenburg that burst into flames and incinerated in front of the eyes of God and all of the American children watching on television, hydrogen is incredibly explosive. And when you hit it with phosphorus, things happen.
Astonishing things. Or terrible things, depending on which side of the war you were on. So now we know that even the people who were German citizens were being deprived of sausage and monitored. And this is strange because we're thinking about intestines, right? But we're exclusively focusing on cattle. So what makes a cow's intestine superior to, say, that of a pig or a goat?
Well, Ben, not to degrade the pig, you know, as it's also one of God's creatures. But yeah, it turns out the cow, the structure of those massive guts are just a lot more substantial, as you could imagine, right?
Right. Spot on. It's a matter of efficiency. And a cow's guts are, as you said, just larger. There's another question that pops up here. Could you make sausage without a casing? What would it be? I'm sure they had to because the intestines were being taken, but not the ground meat that would later become sausage filling, right?
Yeah, it's true. It's like I said at the top of the show, it'd be a lot more like the kind of packaged breakfast sausage you get that comes in a plastic tube rather than an edible, delightful, snappy, gutty tube. But, you know, even some chefs, you know, you really do treat that casing like packaging in some respects, because you will split it open sometimes and use it for various cooking if you're going to do more of a sauce or make a sausage base, you know, or if you want to eat it whole, you got it all right there. It's all ready made for you to just grill up and dig right into. So it's kind of a multi-purpose thing, right?
Yes, multi-purpose indeed. And here's another interesting statistic. Earlier, we had mentioned the amount of cow intestines, right? 250,000 per single Zeppelin. But what does that represent in terms of actual individual sausage casings? According to one estimate from a cool website, if I'll call Edible Geography, I'm in love. According to this estimate, each Zeppelin floating through the air, each operational Zeppelin, represented up to 33 million potential sausage casings.
Man, that is a lot of gutty parts. And let's snap back to reality. You know, you look around today, you don't really see these towering monstrosities lurking in the distance, do you? Unless you go to like a football game. But we know that's more of a blimp situation.
Mm-hmm. That's the Goodyear.
Yeah, and they you know, take really cool aerial shots mm-hmm. of football games and the like, and they're used for advertising. You'll occasionally see one floating around. But no, it's not really a thing. It was such a thing back in the days of World War I that aerial at the top of the Empire State Building was apparently, initially, the idea was to be a docking post for Zeppelins. But it turned out that there were like updrafts from the city mm-hmm. that caused it to be wildly unwieldy. And who would want to hop off a blimp that high above a thriving metropolis? That sounds terrifying. What, would you come down like a giant ladder? I don't know. I don't quite see how that would work.
Maybe just get a wingsuit and give it a shot.
So, you know, Von Zeppelin, he definitely left his mark. And I would say that the remaining mark that he has left behind is more in pop culture and art and film. And this idea of this kind of sinister, looming Leviathan of the sky, mm-hmm. But not so much a functional thing that we do much with anymore. Whereas submarines and other technology developed at the same time, totally still around.
Well, this is fascinating. I love airships. And there's another episode that we have to do, spoiler alert, on the first airborne aircraft carrier.
Ooh.
I know, right? That will be coming up soon, but we do want to end also on a happy note. While the age of airships may have passed, or while airships in general may be in decline, sausage survived World War I, which I'm sure we all sort of understood from walking through a grocery store.
And thank God.
And thank goodness, yes. As of 2016, the average German consumed 4.5 kilograms of sausage alone. That appears to be on the decline year over year, but I don't think it will spell the end of the sausage industry unless somebody comes up with something new to do with those amazingly versatile sausage casings.
Yeah, well, last thing, since we're just in a trivia frenzy right now, did you know that back in the day, another use of those gutty parts were to make, children's balloons for, birthday parties? You know, it's like you could definitely make like a puppy or something out of it. It would probably smell a little weird. But, yeah, it's true. Takes all kinds.
Oh, yeah. And the process of making these things would have smelled abominable. We didn't even mention that part, but you can find information on the strange history of sausage and more by checking out the article on How Stuff Works by Candace Gibson, Ridiculous History, A Nation Sacrifices Its Sausage to Fight a War. And we want to ask you, well, can't speak for both of us. I want to ask you what your opinion is on sausage. Do you have some strong likes or dislikes? Because sausage is one of those things that some people hate.
Oh, yeah. And if you do like sausage, are you a mustard guy or gal? Do you like it just clean, just as is? You like it grilled, boiled? Just give us all your sausage deets. Write to us at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com.
And speaking of you, specifically you, Noel, what do you say to some listener mail?
Let's open the bag.
Oh, cool. We have a bag.
Of course we do. What else? It's made of intestines.
That's why it smells in here.
Yeah. Our first letter comes from Allison M. And she says, hello, Ben, Noel, and podcast staff. Thank you for the lovely podcast episode on Star Trek and MLK. To Trekkies like myself, this is old news, but it's still a lovely story and one I love to hear over and over. Also, Whoopi Goldberg's story about seeing Nichelle Nichols on TV makes me smile every time. Unfortunately, I do feel the need to point out one rather glaring error in the podcast, which made me laugh out loud. You've probably already received a million emails. Well, no, just the one. About this. Us Trekkies can be overly critical and particular about our beloved Trek. Sorry about that. Please forgive me if this email is a million and one. Again, just the one. Noel mentioned how the chemistry is obvious between Uhura and Kirk during the first interracial kiss, and you played a clip of Uhura talking about her trust of Kirk immediately before the history-making clip. The clip, while correct, is a bit out of context. The characters are being held hostage on a planet of very bored beings with strong mental powers that can control the actions of our heroic crew. They dress them up. It's true, they're in like these kind of Greek orgy type outfits, and make them dance and sing and entertain the aliens like puppets on strings. They also force the kiss between Uhura and Kirk. At the point of the kiss, Uhura and Kirk are both, in fact, being sexually assaulted. So, yeah, I tried to cop as much as possible in that episode to not being intimately familiar with the Star Trek canon, and I did think something was a little fishy about that clip, but I still stand by the acting chemistry in the scene. You know what I mean? Like, that was important in and of itself. I will say that. But contextually, story-wise, yeah, I can see how that's a little problematic. Does it cheapen the moment in history? No.
No, it doesn't cheapen the moment in history, but it does make our show better to hear from you. So thanks so much for writing in.
Absolutely.
That's not the end of the letter, though, right?
No, she goes on to say, you both said up front that you're not Trek fans, and it's perfectly understandable how such an error could be made from just that clip without knowledge of the episode plot behind it. Kirk is also a well-known ladies' man, and it seems plausible that he'd get with Uhura, too. This email is not meant as a criticism of your Trek knowledge or research, just an explanation, and I wouldn't have sent it if it weren't for the comment about the chemistry between the two of them. I got a good laugh from that. Thanks. Thanks for all the hard work you do on the podcast and sharing this pivotal moment in TV and civil rights history with the general public. I look forward to new episodes and love learning ridiculous history. So, you know, nice criticism, point well taken, but, you know, she's not unsubscribing, so that's cool. So thank you very much, Allison M.
What a nice email. Thank you so much, Allison M. That was great.
I'll take a ding all day long, and I will cop to any mistake that I make any day of the week, especially when you are so courteous about it.
And Allison, thank you for not sending the Borg after us. See, I did a Star Trek reference.
Yeah, those guys with the pancake makeup on and the weird glowy Terminator eyes.
Oh, they were my favorite. Did you see when Picard got assimilated?
He got Borged.
He got Borged up.
He got Borged, son.
Our next email comes from Megan L. Megan says, hey, Ben and Noel, I've been listening since the pilot episode and really love the pod. Thanks for putting such a whimsical spin on history. I also love those incredible tangents you guys go on. Oh, boy, don't encourage us. I thought, says Megan, I would share with you some ridiculous history from here in the Green Mountain State. Almost 50 years ago, there were plans and blueprints made to put a glass dome over the town of Winooski, Vermont. That's W-I-N-O-O-S-K-I. Forgive us if we mispronounce there. I've linked some articles that get into the details, but it was a crazy plan to combat rising oil prices, the frigid northern temperatures, and also line some pockets with poorly allocated government funding. Some people have heralded it as an incredible innovation, and there was even the International Dome Symposium in 1980, which garnered attention and excitement worldwide. I teach preschool here. Winooski's currently participating in the refugee resettlement program. It's a wonderful town, and I live in a neighboring town. I've been picturing what it would be like to drive into a glass dome every day, and it's just absurd. It really is a great story, and I thought it could make for an interesting episode. Keep up the good work, Megan.
Does that not make you think of that Stephen King Under the Dome business?
Sure. It also makes me think of sort of the retro, modern, futuristic stuff that we saw from the 1960s, like work by Buckminster Fuller, right? Or the ideas that were espoused by Walt Disney.
Or Biodome starring Pauly Shore.
Yes, yes. Biodome starring Pauly Shore. But really a show that was stolen by one of the Baldwin brothers. Wasn't he in there?
I think he was. I think he was his stoner pal. And this wasn't Wheezing the Juice. That was Encino Man, right? Mm-hmm. When they wheezed the juice.
That's correct.
All right. Well, we've got our own juices to wheeze, so we're going to have to close up this bag and head on out for the day.
Right. Thank you so much, Megan L. Thank you, Allison M. And thank you for listening. If you would like to take a page from our friends Allison and Megan, you can find us on the internet. We're all over the place.
You know who I'd like to thank? I'd like to thank you, Ben.
Wow, man, I'd like to thank you.
Oh my God, it's a love-in.
We should send each other, just like nice motivational post-its at our desk every so often.
Slide them to each other under the door.
Let's say
we don't have doors. It's an open office plan.
We could just get frisbees and just draw cartoons and then throw them in the office. Surely that won't be disruptive.
I'm fine with that. Or maybe load them into Nerf guns. I don't know. We'll come back to the drawing board on that. But if we're thanking people, we might as well go ahead and thank our super producer, Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, and Candace Gibson, who contributed, once again, a fantastic article to Ridiculous History.
And though I have to say, this was an incredibly enjoyable episode. I'm sad it ended, but I'm excited to go to our next one, which is going to be really weird.
We're going to talk about Lyndon Johnson's balls.
And his calls. We are actually going to mention some weird trivia about Lyndon Johnson, so do stay tuned.
And be sure to join us for this next episode of Ridiculous History. Thanks, everyone.